This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We all know, some of us more personally than others, that the baby boom generation is getting older. And it doesn't require advanced math to realize that as the boomers begin to retire, Social Security will bear a heavier burden. The leading edge of this biggest demographic bulge in history will turn 65 7 years from now. And yesterday, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress that it has to begin dealing with the crisis now. In testimony before the House Budget Committee, Greenspan went through the remorseless arithmetic of what could be an impending budget disaster. Despite the ballooning deficit, he said raising taxes is not the answer, and he dismissed the idea that increased productivity will solve the problem. What we have to do, he said, is start now to cut Social Security benefits. This is hardly the first time that Alan Greenspan has tried to draw attention to this issue, but yesterday's presentation had a new tone of urgency, and the Fed chairman dropped this political bombshell right into the middle of a presidential campaign. Later in this hour, something for the closer-term future, Oscar Night will help you plan a menu fit for a hobbit, a ship's captain, and a jockey. But first, the economics and the politics of Social Security. How bad is the problem? Are cuts in benefits the only solution? And can a bitterly divided Congress agree on any of them? If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A to help us understand Social Security's origins and its future are Russell Roberts. He's an economics professor from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
My pleasure.
And Robert Kuttner is with us. He's the co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. Bob, good to have you back on as
well. Great to be back.
Russ, let's begin at the beginning. When did Social Security start and why?
Well, it started in the middle of the Great Depression. It started in 1935, I think, 34, 35. And it was designed to be a help to elderly folks who were retiring and who didn't have much money, particularly if they'd been out of work for a while because of the Depression. 1933, we had unemployment of about 25%. It was a little bit frightening. Started off very modest, very small tax rate, very small benefits. And, of course, the beneficiaries who were retiring right shortly after that got a wonderful deal. If they lived to be 80 or 90 or even 67, they got a check that they didn't have to pay much to receive. As the system's gotten older, we've raised the benefits and raised the tax rate. And the system's always exploited the lovely result of it being a pay-as-you-go system. It's not a pension plan. It's not a retirement plan. It's really a welfare program where citizens are taxed to take care of other citizens. There's an assumption that as you get older, you'll be a beneficiary of that program as well if you've earned money in the types of earnings that Social Security gives credit for. But we now have the problem where people born particularly between 1946 and 1955, of which I'm one, the baby boom generation, is a rather large pig going through the body of the python. It's a demographic bulge that will soon be retiring or would like to retire, would like to claim those benefits that have been politically promised to them. But the number of workers who are going to be working to support them will be smaller, not because of economic problems, but pure demographics and population. Mm-hmm. So we have a challenge meeting the promises that have been made to date.
Bob Kuttner, was Social Security designed as a stopgap to cure poverty or as income for the elderly?
Well, it was designed as a program of social insurance. It was instituted in the Great Depression in order to lure people in the workforce into retirement at a time when there was high unemployment so that jobs would be freed up for unemployed working-age people. But it has grown into a very basic program of social insurance that's an earned entitlement. It's based on how much you pay in, even though it's not an annuity. Your benefits are partly dependent on what you paid in. It feels to people like an earned program. It doesn't feel to people like welfare. Unlike welfare, there's no means test. You don't have to prove that you're poor in order to get Social Security. And it has all kinds of other benefits besides the pension benefit. It has disability benefits. It has so-called survivorship benefits, which are like a life insurance policy. If a breadwinner dies, a dependent gets benefits. Widows get benefits. And the result of Social Security has been that the poverty rate among the elderly, which was up around 30% a generation ago, is now slightly below the average rate of poverty for working-age adults. So it has been a tremendous boon for people in old age, and we can't afford it.
Let's talk about what Mr. Greenspan had to say yesterday, and really he had two things to say, it seems to me, one of which was a description of the problem, and Russell Roberts, was he right about that?
Yeah, there's a demographic challenge. The problem is going to be that the current structure of the system, the current set of tax rates, and the current benefit structure can't be sustained as that baby boom generation ages. So his particular prescription was to raise to cut benefits. There are really four choices. There's cut benefits, there's raise taxes, there's reduce spending elsewhere, and there's try something different. One of those four will have to be done, and it's a question of political will and desire to see which one it'll be.
And Bob Kuttner, would you agree the prescription was the description was accurate, and of course the prescription is going to be controversial?
I think a lot of people who are not fundamentally friendly to social insurance, and I would count Alan Greenspan as one of them, exaggerate how serious the financial shortfall is as a way of either cutting benefits or making Social Security something other than a universal program. If you fragment it, then the constituency for it starts to erode. The fact is that the projected shortfall by the Social Security trustees is something like 0.75% of gross domestic product, and the amount of the Bush tax cut is something like 2% of gross domestic product. So for about 1/3 of what Bush took away from federal revenues and tax cuts tilted towards the upper brackets, we could keep Social Security solvent for the next 100 years. Now, Greenspan chose to characterize that as a tax increase. The great majority of these tax cuts haven't even taken effect. If you went back to the tax system that we had in 2001 and allocated some of the general revenues to Social Security, the system would be solvent for our great-grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. Alan Greenspan said it was not just against it. He did describe it as a tax increase. You can describe it as rolling back the tax cuts. But the reason he said it was not a good idea, it seems to me, Russell Roberts, if I heard him correctly, was that it would slow down the economy.
Yeah, that's which would slow down the economy?
Increasing taxes, as he described.
Well, a lot of things would slow down the economy. I think the real issue here is a much more fundamental question. I think there are a lot of ways to reform Social Security or change it where the impact on the economy as a whole is relatively small. I think the deep issue here is one of philosophy.
I would agree.
As Bob is saying, I think the issue here is whether you want to continue with the universal social insurance program or whether you want to move to something different. And I think the question is whether our economic situation today makes a universal social insurance program more attractive or less attractive. And for some, it makes it less attractive, others more attractive. I think that's the key philosophical issue. Do we want the government providing for most of being responsible for our retirement, or do we want to have our responsibility to take care of that for ourselves?
Well, the government is not responsible for most of our retirement. Social Security, as a universal system of social insurance, provides a floor. So that it provides a basic level so that people in old age do not starve. But on top of this bottom layer of the cake, we have everything from corporate pension plans to 401ks to private savings to stock market investments, and no one is prevented from having as many of those as they can afford or as they choose. And of course, on top of that, we have all kinds of tax incentives to encourage people to put money into IRAs and KEOs and 401ks and the rest. So the question is, do you want to remove this bottom layer, which is insurance against poverty in old age? It's insurance against living too long. Nice thing about Social Security is you can't outlive it. You can live to be 105 and the checks keep coming in. And I think it would be absolute folly to get rid of this one bottom layer.
But why not just keep that bottom layer? And why add on all the complicated, not the things you were talking about, the corporate pension plans and 401ks, but all the complex and quite difficult to discern redistributional effects that are built into the current Social Security system? Why not just have that floor as a true poverty program, which is an important part of the program, but why then have the additional distortions of the taxes? The existence of Social Security makes tax reform extremely difficult because those revenues are mixed in. We pretend they're not. We pretend they're earmarked for Social Security, when in fact it just goes into general revenue right now. So why not just have a purely that floor for poor people, but not for other folks like yourself or myself who don't need it?
Would you have to prove that you were poor in order to get the benefit?
Yeah, what'd be wrong with that? We do that all the time.
Well, but that would ruin the program because, for starters, you'd have to get rid of assets. When you have a means-tested program where you have to prove that you're destitute in order to get the benefits, they make you get rid of your house, they make you get rid of your car, people look at your income statements, and that completely ruins it as a universal social insurance program.
Oh, that's correct. It does ruin the universal part. I just wouldn't ruin it for you and me, because I suspect you and me and about 100-something million other Americans wouldn't be worried about divesting our house to get the floor that Social Security would promise.
I can't believe you're saying that. I mean, most elderly people, until they're ready to move into nursing homes, don't want to have to prove destitution. They want to get their Social Security checks, as they currently do, as a matter of right. They don't want a government investigator making sure they've sold off their car and making sure they're destitute.
No, but I'm thinking about a 30-year-old today who isn't really excited about the political fight ensuing over Social Security, and say to that 30-year-old, would you like to be responsible for your own retirement, or would you rather have the government take care of part of that? I think a lot of people would say, I'm pretty comfortable earning that money along the way, taking care of myself.
Well, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email TOTN at NPR.org. We'll begin with Ed, who is with us from Wausau, Wisconsin.
Hi. Thank you for the program. One of your guests was talking about Social Security being a welfare program. However, my knowledge of history is back in the 80s, along with Senator Moynihan and I think Reagan was involved, a number of people, and they realized that this pig, as you called it, coming down the system was going to be there, and they actually planned for it at that time, and that's why they formed something, accounting-wise, that was called the Social Security Trust Fund. In other words, they were planning for the baby boomers to retire. One thing that a lot of people they're not really looking at, that you have two things that are happening in governmental accounting, and that's that you have a taxation system that produces income, and also you control your spending.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just looking at one side of the balance sheet and ignoring the 1980s when Congress already tackled this problem.
Ed, let me ask Bob Kuttner. I mean, Congress created the Social Security Trust Fund and then spent it regularly every year, didn't they?
Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. I mean, the real question is whether the system is in or out of balance over the long term. And what's interesting is that during the past 6 years, each year the Social Security trustees project when the system is going to run out of money. In their 1997 report, they projected that the system was going to run out of money in 2029. In their 2003 report, they projected that the system has enough money until 2042. So in 6 years, the system added 13 more years of longevity. Why? Because economic growth has been better than the trustees rather pessimistically forecast. So I think the crisis is grossly exaggerated, and it's particularly exaggerated by people who philosophically don't believe in universal social insurance.
Thanks very much for the call, Ed.
Yes.
We're talking about the future of Social Security, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, if you'd like to get in touch with us that way, is TOTN@NPR.org. And when we come back, we'll talk about the politics of Social Security and how that's likely to play out in the 2004 elections. Will the nominee's position on this issue affect how you cast your vote? Again, 800-989-8255. Our guests are Russell Roberts, an economics professor at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and Bob Kuttner, co-editor of The American Prospect. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the health of Social Security and how it may look in the future. That after a very gloomy forecast yesterday by the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Alan Greenspan. You're invited to join our discussion. Do you think you'll be receiving Social Security checks when you retire? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now in Studio 3A to talk about the role of Social Security as a political issue is NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Good to have you all here, Ron.
Good to be with you, Neil.
This is a high season in the presidential race. How did President Bush respond to Chairman Greenspan's remarks yesterday?
He separated himself from them as quickly as he could because he did not want to be associated with the notion that Social Security benefits needed to be cut or that there was no other way to deal with some of the fiscal problems of the nation other than to address entitlement programs, because that's exactly the kind of thing that would get any incumbent, particularly a Republican incumbent, in trouble at this particular moment.
And how did Senators Kerry and Edwards respond?
Well, equally predictably, they are Democratic candidates for president, and they are immediately going to say that Social Security and Medicare cannot be touched, and that if they were to be president, certainly Senator Kerry immediately said if he were to be president, this would not be the way deficits would be addressed, and that Social Security should not be cut. And Senator Edwards immediately said it was an outrage to talk about cutting Social Security at the same time that you were talking about making permanent the income tax cuts that we've seen in this administration, which were also mentioned, by the way, by Chairman Greenspan, who was in favor of making them permanent.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is has been in the past, don't touch Social Security has been a Democratic issue for as long as I can remember, and a very successful one.
Yes, it's been, part of the standard armory of any Democratic candidate to say that Republicans who had never been truly friendly to Social Security or Medicare and that they'd opposed them when they were created and that they would try to privatize Social Security if they possibly could. And to some degree, certainly at the margins, Republicans do propose at least a partial privatization of Social Security. It's been a way to shore up votes among seniors and other people who depend on Social Security and to cast the Republicans back into Herbert Hoover times and colors and hues, if you will.
Does it divide neatly along Democratic-Republican lines, or is there an aspect of generational politics?
Oh, I think it's primarily, in many respects, generational politics. If you look at the polls, people under a certain age don't really expect, in the same way that their elders do, to receive Social Security and Medicare benefits in the way that their elders do. And there would seem to be a growing generational division over how important it is to maintain the levels of these programs. Of course, for people who are already retired, as the president immediately said, no one is contemplating changing existing levels for those already retired or about to retire. And, of course, he wanted to make that clear immediately, and so did a lot of other Republican leaders and candidates. Usually where the rub comes is in setting the age at which we are talking about changing what the benefits are. Are we talking about people who are in their 50s, people who are in their 40s, people who are in their 30s? Where do you move the bar and say, now, at that point, we may start to adjust? And, of course, as Greenspan makes the case, we are going to have to make some species of adjustment at some point or another, because eventually there are fewer and fewer workers supporting a greater and greater number of people who are retired.
Now, there is a situation where we have a closely divided electorate and a closely divided Congress. Is there any prospect that this can be an agreement on some combination of, let me wildly project, some cuts in benefits, some increases in taxes, as you know, something that might be a compromise here, given the political situation that we have now and given this year, certainly?
Well, I don't want to be cynical, and I do want to be hopeful that our process can work, but not in a year divisible by four. In a presidential year, it's extremely difficult to get the two parties to trust each other enough to do this, and in the absence of a crisis. Now, you go back 20 years, 1983, Greenspan was part of a commission, head of a commission, that did look at a lot of these issues and did come up with a temporary, emphasis temporary, bailout for Social Security at that time. It's not unimaginable that it could happen, but it's not going to happen in the heat of a campaign.
And is it in the heat of the campaign going to be a sellable issue for either side, either the privatization argument that we hear from some Republicans or the Save Social Security standard that the Democrats have waived successfully for so long?
I think it will be an applause line for both parties. They'll each use their own terms. Each use their own rhetoric, and they'll appeal to the same sense of righteousness and outrage within their constituencies, and it'll be a big applause line at both conventions.
Are we going to have to get closer to this? Is the gun being held to all of our heads going to have to get bigger and warmer? And is it going to have to be a non-election year, though those are coming fewer and farther between than ever before, for both parties to concentrate on this problem, do you think?
Sadly, yes. We just really are not able to come to grips with something, I think, of this magnitude in the absence of a crisis.
Ron Elving, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NPR's political senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, was with us here in Studio 3A and wanted to bring our guest into that conversation, Bob Kuttner, the American Prospect.
Well, two things. With respect, and I'm a devoted NPR fan, I think both of you guys are buying into the premise that there's a severe crisis and that politics is preventing us from dealing with it. If you read the Social Security Trustees report, there's not a severe crisis. We need some modest adjustments. If you took one-third of the money represented by Bush's tax cuts, that would make the system whole. Now, you can also choose to reduce benefits or push back the retirement age, which is just another way of reducing benefits. So I think Chairman Greenspan has lobbed a very useful grenade into the presidential debate, useful from the point of view of defenders of social insurance, because it reminds voters and political leaders that it is Bush's tax cut that has made it much, much more difficult to make the relatively modest adjustments in Social Security that can head off benefit cuts or needless raising of the retirement age.
Let me read an email that we got in putting and asking you for a response, Russ Roberts, that we got from Paul Clayton in New York. As a 26-year-old, I assume Social Security won't be around for me. Am I right?
Depends. I think Bob Kuttner's right. If we want it to be around, it will be, although I'm not quite as optimistic as he is about the ease of which we can cope with it. I'd like to hear, Bob, your estimate of what you think the payroll tax would have to be to cover that deficit. Do you know that number? I don't know it offhand myself.
I wouldn't touch the payroll tax. I would just do what the original President's Commission on Economic Security proposed in 1935 and divert some share of general revenues into the Social Security trust funds as the population ages, which you could do if you weren't blowing so many holes in the general revenue.
Well, here's something at least we agree on. I'd like to see it funded totally by general revenue, so this complex system of payroll tax, half paid by the employer, half paid by the employee, wouldn't make tax reform so complicated. But as to the emailer, the 26-year-old, actually, even though I think it may be there, I suspect that it won't be, at least in the form that we know it. I believe that privatization will come in some form. It may not happen this year. It may not happen. It won't happen this year. It may not even be seriously approached in the second Bush administration if he wins. And if he doesn't win, it won't be approached by a Democrat. But I believe in the future that a system where we take more responsibility for our own retirement as our nation gets wealthier is a natural evolution. I think it's inevitable.
Let's get some more listeners on the line. And Paul joins us from Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Hi. I've got a couple of questions for your guests. This is a wonderful discussion. The first one is a comment. Back 20 years ago when we started borrowing money from the Social Security Trust Fund, the monies that were collected for the future, they were supposed to be paid back to the people who are going to retire in the future. Now we're talking about declining income because we won't have enough money to pay the retirees, so therefore the retirees are going to have to pay twice. Once in the higher benefits for the last 20 years that we have put in to cover the debt and the deficit, and once again when we're retired. It's an unfair balance.
So you feel like you're getting caught coming and going?
Oh, absolutely, positively, we all are.
Any justice to that, Bob Kuttner?
That's awfully hard to do in 20 seconds. I think if we do this right, we won't have to raise taxes beyond clawing back some of the Bush tax cut for the upper brackets. We won't have to cut benefits. So I hope this gentleman doesn't end up paying twice.
No, you're misunderstanding. As a future retiree in about 10 years.
We all like to think of ourselves as future retirees.
That's right.
If we're lucky.
But in about 10 years, I'm going to retire.
Right.
And if I get less benefits, I then am paying for it in less benefits, again, as well as in higher Social Security taxes to cover a deficit and a debt that has been ballooning out of control by the Republican Party for the last 20 years.
Well, Democrats have been in power for some of those 20 years, but go ahead.
You are going to get slightly reduced benefits relative to what you might have gotten if you had retired 20 years ago because of the work of the 1983 compromise, where they pushed the retirement age back first to 66, then to 67, and they trimmed the cost of living adjustment a little tiny bit. So to that extent, you're right. I don't think it's the result of the debt, because either when the government goes into debt, It either goes into debt by selling bonds to the general public, or it goes into debt by borrowing from Social Security. It's the same debt.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But the real question is what kind of world we want to live in. You know, my kids, what kind of world are they going to have? What are they going to be responsible for? What will their tax rates be? How much economic freedom they'll have? How much of a social insurance they'll have? I think that's the real question. Do we want that world of the universal social insurance? I don't. What's the virtue of that in a world where we have the wealth and economy that we're able to have? I think that's the challenge.
Who's the we? I mean, a lot of people, we in this room may have that wealth, but 66% of Americans over age 65 depend on Social Security for half their income. And I want that to be there. Maybe my Social Security check, which is going to be about $20,000 a year, hopefully that's only a third or a fourth or a fifth of my retirement income. But for the vast majority of Americans, it's a lot of what you have in old age. And no one prevents you from saving more money on top of that during your working years.
That's true. But the caller we just had one of the reasons 66% of those folks are depending on Social Security is that for their entire working life, they had to spend 15% of their income, either paid by themselves or their employer, to pay out to other retirees. So you can't just ignore that. That's part of the real question is, what would the world look like with a different system? It would look different.
Well, you'd have less social insurance for old people.
Let's get Marshall on the line. Marshall's with us from Sunnyvale, California.
Yes, I'm one of those younger generation folks who doesn't think that Social Security is going to be around, or even if it is, that it's not necessarily a good deal for us. I'm a person who has saved my own money, my nest egg, and built it up, and why would I give my money to another entity to have them do the same thing for me? That's just adding cost and bureaucracy to that program. And
that entity being the U.S. government.
Right. Why isn't this program an opt-out program, meaning on my tax form, or I don't know, at some point in my life, why can't I just opt out of this program and say, I will never be entitled to these benefits in my life, and I am willing to take that risk and that responsibility to not get that paycheck after 62 and a half or whenever it is. Why can't it be opt out? And I'll take my comments off the air.
As young as 62 and a half. But anyway, Bob Cutner.
Well, I think if you believe that, and 51% of the people believe that, we won't have a Social Security program. I think the counter is that you can't foresee what's going to happen to you over the next 40 or 50 years, and if you're destitute in old age, you're going to expect society to take care of you one way or another. You're going to change your mind if you need those services, if you need that health insurance, and you'll be glad the safety net is there.
We have to mention that we're speaking with Bob Cutner, who's the co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, and with Russell Roberts, who's an economics professor from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. And you're listening to us on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email, a subject we mentioned earlier, from Leslie Cunningham in Minneapolis. Why don't we means test Social Security? Do multimillionaires need to collect Social Security? Aren't they secure enough in their social standing? And Russell Roberts, that's one of the things that you were talking about.
Well, I just don't. If you talk to a multimillionaire now, I think plenty of them would be happy to, whether they're 55 or 70, a lot of them would be happy to forego their Social Security benefits. But others would say, I contributed, I earned it, and I want to get it back. I think that's a bit of a myth. It's an illusion that we're encouraged to believe that we earned it. Our money is not sitting in our account for us. It's not earning interest. It's not earmarked for us. There's a complicated formula that determines how much money you get. It is related to how much you earn, but the formula changes. There's no rule. You're not promised a particular return on your money. And so that's just the way the system works.
Okay.
Well, in fact, there is a rule, and every year, everybody who contributes payroll taxes to the system gets a form from the Social Security Administration. I got mine about 3 weeks ago that says, if you retire at 62, this is what your pension is going to be. If you retire at 66, if you retire at 70.
The only reason my wife hangs out with me, I'll
tell
you
right.
That. That's
right. The millionaire question is a very good question. And the answer is, having a few millionaires get Social Security, even though they don't need it, is a small price to pay for keeping a universal system that doesn't require the rest of us to prove that we're destitute. If you required people to prove that they were destitute, the program would be ruined. Programs that are just for people who are certifiably poor tend to be underfunded, they tend to be stigmatized, they tend to be shameful, and they tend to fall apart.
Can we go back to that letter, though? That letter that you got 3 weeks ago? I'm curious about that, because that was a program that Social Security started a while back to send us those letters. Those letters are not really a promise of what we would get when we're 62. It's a promise of what you would get if you were 62 today. I assume you're not 62. So it's a promise is not even quite the right word. Certainly not a guarantee. It's not a contract. It's a vague description of how the program works. And I think what some of the callers are worried about, and what I'm not worried about it. I agree with you that it's not a worry. But the question is, do we want to keep that promise? Do we want to keep that structure the way it is?
Well, we don't have to.
I do. My stomach just flipped over when you said that. Anyway, let's get another caller on the air. Dan is with us from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi.
How's it going?
All right.
Good. I guess this is a question for The Economist. I'm not sure. But if, you know, most people have their wealth in their houses and in the stock market, and you're going to have the baby boomers all aging, retiring, and dying around the same time, isn't there going to be a net movement out of the stock market and out of the housing market at just the time when people need that wealth to retire on? And this is, that question is addressed also to people who want the privatization. Do you understand my question?
I do understand the question, except for one thing. None of us are going to die, Dan. But anyway, Bob Cummings.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's just me.
Well, they're not all going to retire at once, even though there's a fairly large cohort.
Because it's the demographic bulge, it will be over a period of 20 years. There'll be more people retiring than there are now,
right,
is the problem, right?
Well, depending on your political preferences, there are two ways to argue this. You can say, right, this is going to mean that the stock market is going to go down because of supply and demand. There are going to be more sellers of stock and fewer buyers of stock. So if you're pro-privatization of Social Security, that would tell you, let's get a lot of these payroll tax receipts and put them into buying stocks, and that'll pump up the stock market. If you like Social Security the way it is, you would conclude that if the stock market is more iffy in the future, that's all the more reason to keep Social Security as part of the retirement system and not mess with it.
And thereby having people who invested in the stock market and then saw their savings go away and facing, very quickly, Ross, I know I
think the effect's somewhat exaggerated. We're in a world capital market, and even large retirements from the United States, I don't think, are going to have a big impact on stock returns. I think the real issue here on privatization is, what are the assets that people are going to be available to people to invest in? Are you going to be limited to certain approved mutual funds, certain fixed asset funds? A lot of times when we think about privatizing Social Security, we think of the stock market, which is a highly risky place in the short run and in the long run. But there are other assets available as well.
And we're going to have to leave it there, but a subject to which we will return in discussion, I'm sure, many times. Thanks to you both. Robert Kuttner, co-editor of The American Prospect, Russell Roberts, economics professor at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. They were both with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, we'll take dinner and a movie to new heights with Hollywood-inspired recipes, right in time for Oscar night. If you can't watch The Godfather without a bowl of linguine at your side, call us with your favorite movie foods, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.